Thanks for the kind invitation here to the ICP, and this for the first opportunity to present our the newest results outside our own research group at Ames and Santa Cruz. So what I want to talk about today is solar turbulence, electricity generation, and environmental transport, all in the context of protoplanetary accretion disks, but this is just a special feature I'm interested in, and the mechanism which we were saying is the main cause of feeding is baroclinic instability. I'm working on this project together with Peter Bodenheimer, but in the in our discussion group, and also more people like Phil Harris, in Potsdam, in Uzai, in Heidelberg, Robin Spell at Ames, and then also at UC Santa Cruz. I will first give a small introduction because I don't know where, how far everyone is familiar with star formation stuff. I will talk a little bit about technical stuff about the code I'm working with. I will start with some comparisons to work which is published in the literature. I will then go on to our newest results and sum up with conclusions. Well, the objects I want to model or I'm interested in are protoplanetary disks and Hubble Space Telescope is taking me on very nice pictures of them. So what you see there are the silhouette nebulas in the Orion nebula. So what you see there is that you don't see the background. So the background is ionized gas, this is dry, but here must be some dust, and that's why and this dust is getting a shadow in front of the background. You don't see the background. But we also see some emission coming from a quiet object. So the interpretation of these objects is we are having here a protoplanetary nebula. This object here is something like in the order of between 20 and 100 astronomical units in diameter, and this is maybe a future solar system. But we don't see in these pictures very much about these disks, so we don't know the size of the dust grains, for instance, or are there planets in, or are these disks here, for instance, accreting matter to the central object or not? From these observations, you can't see this. And actually, for these objects, it's completely unknown whether they are accretion disks or not. There are some.
These are just different views of the same object.
No, no, these are four different objects.
In oh, four different
in the same kind of phenomena. This is a complete different disk. It's not. Before that, I said there a solar system could form because the mass of the central object was in the order of one solar mass. This is a heavier object, an AD star. But also these objects, if they are young, have very nice disks around them. And here you see a little bit more about the structure and the scattered kind of light of the central object. And you see that they're mixed with a little bit of fantasy. You see something like spirals in there. But it's also not very much known what's going on in the disk. So the picture of star formation
is already a central object. This is already right.
Sure, yeah, right.
So
it's already classified, it's a pre-main sequence AD star, or it's already a main sequence because they have such a short pre-main sequence.
So it's already a few times 10 to the 6 years old, or 10 to 7 years old.
Right. Yeah, so yeah. The, about this. So before that, the objects were T-Taurus stars, yeah. So they're younger. The general idea about star formation is that at some point molecular cloud is collapsing because of the force of which is slightly rotating, angular momentum rotation. You end up with something flattened, which has a central object and a disk around it. Here you have the space where space, some people are familiar with these nice pictures of the star with the disk and outflow from both directions. Later on, you still have you have the so-called is the taller phase where you have a pre-main sequence starting to end with disk around it. Later, the envelope disappears, but you have still some random of disk material on it. And finally, you have at least in our solar system and a few others which are known, some some planets swirling around the central object. So what I'm interested in, principle in this regime, and my general motivation always came from how our planets grow in such a system.
For this to scale, what kind of a mass would you think of here?
20%, 50% of the stellar mass, and here you're approaching something like 1% of the stellar mass, which is very interesting. So, in these calculations, you have a self-gravitating object, while here the disk is no longer self-gravitating.
But how much of the... you have 10,000 AU collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
How much mass isn't that?
Oh, in this, in the models you assume it's 100% fission, so it's one solar mass which is collapsing.
Okay. But the efficiency isn't really 100%.
Yeah, but people are discussing this.
It's probably at least 90%.
People are discussing this actually, so nobody would.
It would be more than 100%.
Yeah.
Then you have absolutely.
Because
so you need more than
four
mass to make a four mass.
Okay. Yeah, but that
I would
call less than
100%. Yeah. The question is whether you leave it behind or not.
Yeah, okay.
That's difficult. But also then if you really start with such a collapse calculation, how many objects are formed? Only one or their fragmentation?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So, but I'm already in the very late ages of the system, where I already have my star, maybe not already hydrogen burning, but...
Skipping the difficult parts.
No, the first ones, I mean the easy ones, in the sense that angular momentum transport, at least there, works due to self-gravity. So people did a lot of calculation about this. If you just have a heavy disk and let it run, then self-gravity will reorganize angular momentum very efficiently. And it's just a question what happens afterwards after you have such a light, disk light. From other calculations, from other observations, it's known or interpreted that these disks are actually, some tutorial disks are accreting. And the way this is measured, one is observing the ultraviolet excess around these stars. And this ultraviolet excess is coming from the mass flowing from the disk onto the star. And out of this you can calculate some accretion rate. This is solar masses per year, 10 to minus 6, 10 to minus 10 solar masses per year. And you also can estimate some lifetimes of the disks you observe, which are here in the range between 25 to 27 years. And out of this you can estimate some efficiency of the mass transport in the disk. And now we are coming to the general problem.
What are those lines there?
Which lines? Yeah, you see how poor the models are today. So you have to look at the
observers.
They have just scattered point cloud, and then you're trying to
get
through it. So
it doesn't pass the remove 2 points test.
Yeah, well, the observer is perfect.
Theory may be okay, you have poor data there.
Maybe you just have a cloud
thing. My model.
But in the paper actually they have very nice power law, how accretion flow, accretion rate is decreasing over time, and in principle they just to interpret data. But in principle here values are a little bit higher than maybe in this white cloud down here. Well, and the way they are modeling these is they are using alpha disks, so very, very simple disk models, which would already explain why there is such a scattering in the... Well, now we are coming to the basic problem of these disks, which is accretion. Accretion of mass through the disk onto the central object is only possible if we are getting rid of angular momentum for the material. And this angular momentum transport is exactly what I'm interested in. So the idea we have, I think, we write about the transplanetary accretion disk is roughly more or less the following. Around the central object, we have here a picture of the disk that is nice with the disk. There is an inner region, maybe also 1.1 NU, depending on the mass, can be also a little bit further out. This value can be argued, but I think no one believes that this inner zone could be farther out than one astronomical unit. Here, the disk is very hot, the disk is completely ionized, no dust is present, because the dust already is evaporated. Here, magnetohydrogen effects are, as I believe, the most are the dominant processes. You know, here we have magnetohydrogen turbulence, but it's cold and stuff, and some accretion onto the central object. On the other hand, you can talk about the outer region of the disk, maybe beyond 30 astronomical units. Here, the disk is already optically thin, probably. It's quite cold, still a lot of mass there, and you can think about whether a self-search is a reliable mechanism out there. But what happens actually in the zone where planets are thought to be forming, which is roughly between 0.1 and 30 astronomical units? It's just too warm in there to have self-gravity acting. If you're talking about 200 parameters, you have values about 20, 30, where you would need values below 1 in order to have self-gravity. On the other hand, it's very cold in there, which means dust grains are present. And these dust grains are sucking all the free electrons up, and so it's very complicated to get MHD turbulence going in there. There are, for instance, speculations like what Charles Gummy did, that there's actually that a dead zone where nothing is happening and only from the surface some ionization is working and some turbulence is being introduced from the outside in there. But basically it's in the moment the question whether there is turbulence in this regime, the meter or whatever, or no transport at all. So
what is the thickness scale here?
The aspect ratio of the disk is typically 0.1, 0.05, so it's what we call a thin disk. Yeah, but what we know about this region is that there are dust grains. And the dust grains have opacities, and these opacities lead to a superadiabatic gradient in the vertical direction. And so we know that at least as long as there's heat content in the disk, there will be thermal convection. And that, of course, for several authors, the starting point for the idea that thermal convection somehow redistributes angular momentum in the disk. Not very successfully. Some people who did axisymmetric calculations found that alpha stresses were always negative, which means angular momentum was always being shuffled inward. And this is generally true for every convection which is axisymmetric. So no positive alpha stresses were ever observed there. This one, the most influential paper in this field was published by Stone and Vargas 4 years ago. They performed a shearing box calculation of a protoplanetary accretion disk. And you can look it up here in 1996. They had a few assumptions in there, like it's almost incompressible, but the main point is they measured that in the Caperian disk the Reynolds stresses are negative. There, in the same year, they published another paper investigating nonlinear instabilities in Caperian disks, so not looking for convection, but just pure hydro shear instabilities, and also. And they found in this calculation that any turbulence which was introduced into the system rapidly decays. So the calculation they did was looking like this. You see you have a bus in here, some azimuthal extent, some regular extent, some vertical extent. But in order to do the shear box calculation in a disk, you have to do a very, very local calculation, which means the pressure scale height in this is only 1%, so 10 times smaller in order to get everything more Cartesian. So also the regular extent of the disk was only 1% of the radius, and the same is true in the azimuthal. And so this was somehow a starting point that we said, well, maybe if we are just using a bigger box like them and them, then we will end up with some other result. So the code we are using for this approach we call TREM, and it's in principle a very similar approach to Zeus, and was actually in the same time developed. So, and was my thesis to do the three-dimensional version of the previously 2D code. For the following calculation, we are using spherical coordinates. It's a simple second-order Van Leer advection. Previous stuff we did with excessive viscous force, but this is switched off. We just have some artificial viscosity, which means some Richtmeier. So, and the actual calculations I'm showing today don't have any artificial heating in there. So, whatever is going in there in terms of convection is just the disk is cooling, or in some other stuff I will show some holotropic calculations. If the disk is cooling, it's only possible if you have radiation transport in this code. This is the specialty of this squeezy stuff. We have an implicit radiation transport, which is a blast-limited diffusion of the radiation energy density.
Why does it have to be implicit?
The radiation transport?
Yeah.
Because the time scale is just much shorter in certain regimes than where you're getting optical sense than any current.
It's like photon advection. It's like photon advection.
Right, as long as you're in the same diffusive regime, your time scales are pretty long, but as soon as you're getting optical thin, your typical velocity is the speed of light.
Right, but we're doing that. You don't have to do this.
You have a time independent thing. If you do radiation, you do time independent. That's like doing somebody doing this time dependence, but then implicitly because time.
This has the speed of light in the code?
It would be explicit. The time dependence is in front of the time dependence for the time, for the radiation.
Yeah, time dependent radiation
transport.
Okay. Yeah. Because I have local heating and cooling, so the entire energy function.
Oh, but that's not time dependent in a serious way. Oh, we can talk about that later.
Okay,
good.
Point.
What do you mean by flux limited diffusion?
Excuse me?
What do you mean by flux limited diffusion?
It's an approximate way of doing the right thing.
Right, but what I mean by that, I'm using it, I'm solving the diffusion equation for the radiation energy density, but wherever my optical depth drops below a certain value of 2/3, it's interpolating into the screening limit. It's von Mannig, never more von Mannig.
What is alpha viscosity? Alpha viscosity.
What is this?
Yes, what is it?
It's a way of measuring, the value?
No. What is it physically?
Oh, what is this physically? When people came up with the model of treating this Chakravarti and Yard, so for trimming it into observations. They wanted to have a scale-free viscosity. So they said whatever viscosity we have in there, angular momentum redistribution, should be scaled on something which is typically for the radius. And so they came up that alpha viscosity is proportional to a typical velocity, which is the sound speed, and the local pressure scale one. And then they said, well, this is maybe it's a high value, so let's multiply it with alpha, which is a value one or smaller. So people in the planetary formation scenario are now playing around with these values. It's difficult to say what the real answer would be.
Do I understand you correctly on that subject that you put in an alpha viscosity in addition to the transport that is generated by the instabilities and so forth you're going to study?
We did this not very successfully, that's why there are threads around this. So we can do this. If you just want to study convection, this is fine. because then you have some self-consistent heating and so on. But if you're studying instability, it's killing you because
then... I hope you turn it off.
Right, yes, right.
Okay.
Because even if you have alpha voltage of 10 to minus 2 in these calculations, you only have wavelength terms of 100, and there nothing is happening. Right. Very crucial point is now boundary conditions. As you see up here, spherical coordinates are the coordinates of choice in these calculations because it wants to have a huge as possible portion of this. But on the other hand, performing calculations which are not extending over hundreds of AU, you only a small section, you have to think about what are the perfect value of boundary conditions. Something nice, you want to do local calculations like in shearing sheet, where you just assume that you have periodic Cartesian coordinates. So we wanted to do something similar, and that's why we came up with a new system of boundary conditions we call shearing sheets. And just a brief description of what I mean by that is, in the shearing sheet, you just transform your Cartesian coordinates, you just transform your grid values from the one side of your computational domain to the other side. So you have periodic conditions. But the spherical coordinates, that's not so easily possible because you have global gradients. So density is generally getting smaller to the outside, also temperature is dropping. On the other hand, the Capitonian profile is your constraint on your rotation cell. But we assume that every quantity which I have to use for my ghost cells is proportional to some power law, which is usually the case in Cartesian fields. And so then we are using this geometry factor in principle to translate density values from the outside of the disk to the inside of the disk. And so we ended up with very smooth flow patterns. And now it's a question what power laws to use for these quantities, and I think it's obvious for the Clairian profile, so for the angular momentum which is in the disk, so velocity should be something proportional to the R minus 1 half. Pressure scalar is assumed to be constant in these calculations, so you can end up with a law for temperature. Turbulent velocity gives you is also scaled over the sound speed. Then additional things are in there like mass conservation, and also the strain that no kinetic energy is being generated due to these boundary conditions. So let's now have a look how these calculations are looking like.
Before you actually present the results, can you elaborate a little bit more on how this is going to be different from standard developments? I mean, you said, well, they're just assuming a small box, and we're going to make it larger.
This is exactly how the next steps in the talk will be. That you see the difference between the boxes.
Is it simply that you're doing a more global simulation and you're including background gradients in the flow? Or is it that your boundary conditions are going to allow mode reflections between the walls of the...
To give you the quick answer is, I have an entropy gradient in the radius, which was not possible in the shearing box calculation.
You have a radial entropy.
Right, which is a natural outcome of any real thermodynamics of the disk. So this is the answer. And I'll show you how we thought about this. This is still pretty local calculations, but it's already 10 times wider.
Do you do the same shearing sheet as in
The only difference lies in the scale factor of density and also velocity.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty similar to the shear case. So this is kind of boxes we are using. You see here, it's a test calculation. which stands from 4.4 to 5.6 AU, which is already 10 times wider than the calculation Gauss model did. It's 30 degrees in the azimuth. The Gauss model calculation was 1.7 degrees. And it's here plus minus basically in the vertical. And what you see here are the convection cells which are forming in this flow. And we were a little bit surprised because in the loss calculations we observed positive Reynolds stresses. And so the question was, where do they come from? First,
there is no symmetry with respect to the equatorial plane then.
The
cells go all over.
Yeah, right.
They cross the plane.
They cross the plane, right. Even the center of the disk is convectively stable, so it's just because of some overshoot which is going to do. So the first study we did showed the following, that if we are just decreasing the azimuthal extent of the disk, then this is only a 7 degree calculation, then you
so
see
what
everything
staying
symmetric. The energy source. In these calculations, it was still general heating due to the shear. But we are later switched off the.
You mean alpha?
It's in principle similar to. Yeah, it's in principle some alpha heating, but no alpha dissipation of kinetic energy. We are increasing the heat, but not decreasing the kinetic energy.
So there are also no mechanical stresses. There are also no viscous mechanical stresses.
Right.
There's just viscous heating.
Yeah. So the viscous heating is just being added.
Yeah, but for the purpose of this discussion, isn't it just sufficient to say you have put in some heating in the midplane, which is localized in the midplane?
Without
referring to viscous properties.
So it's basically a volumetric heating rate.
Right.
But
it
has
both
viscous heating
and proportional to the being proportional to the main shear, which is just proportional to the criterion shear.
The main shear, but not the
relative. We also did this. Doesn't make a big change. Right. But actually, when we switched off the heating, the results remained the same. And then the heating source is just the vertical contraction of the disk. So you can then run your disk for hundreds of orbits, and the disk is then losing half its thermal energy being radiated away, and so contracting by a factor of two, but it's still being convective. So
where does the radial entropy gradient come from in that
case? The entropy gradient anyway comes from the gravity gradient. So, but just a second. So, and in fact, if you have such a axisymmetric symmetric calculation, in fact, alpha values are negative. And if I'm talking here about alpha, I will have different components of alpha later. That's why I define it here. If alpha ij is 2iuj scaled over the tau square. So the fluctuations in here, and then taking some mean over the time, and at least having it, but also very often also the particle mean of the stress. So you see 7 degrees produces negative alpha stresses, 15 I don't show you, it's just the transition, and 30 degrees, which corresponds to a wave number of m equals 12. The flow really starts to get a little bit wavy, and in fact in this toy calculation you really see a transition up to positive value, so it's not just a...
But what is the degree of 7 degrees?
What's the angle?
Oh sorry, that's the azimuthal extent of the disk, so which I was doing. I'm still not doing 360 degrees because it's very expensive. I'm increasing it 7, 15 and 30 degrees in the azimuth.
But I mean, isn't the simple way of looking at your results that if you write out the general expression for the angular momentum transport for a shear differentially rotating system, it of course depends incredibly strongly on the shape of the eddy. So by changing the angle, you're effectively changing the class of eddies that you allow to be transported.
That's right. That's right. That's right. But we started calculations from both ends. So starting calculations from 360 degrees just showed we are abhorrently under-resolved. And so we just started from good resolution and then tried to push it up to bigger values. And there we were interested because we saw such a critical transition. But you see also the alpha stresses here in alpha 10 to minus 4 are still pretty small. Now I should remind you that for observations you need alpha values, to explain observations today, you need values between 10 to minus 4 and 10 to minus 2 as typical alpha values.
While you're on that subject, is there any consensus on the radial profiles of alpha that you might need?
Oh, in the model, say alpha is constant, which is probably not true.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. Right?
Yeah, right.
Well, that's actually not consistent with the
Fermi
model, because the inferred temperature
profile. Right. So I just say most models think that alpha could be a constant, but if you have then also played around with it and showed, well, this part can be better fit with 10 to minus 4 and this part maybe better with 10 to minus 3. But in the very naive models, you're assuming a constant accretion rate and a constant alpha value. This is already a little bit more global calculation, so it's 90 degrees out of the distance, so already thought. It's one of our most expensive calculations we did so far. 102 in the radius, 40 large different cells, 120 in the eddy movement. And they are so very expensive because I need hundreds of orbits, which means to run something like this, it's millions of time steps. And it's really expensive. That's why we don't have all of this.
What is the color coding?
The color coding is density, what you see in here, and also velocity. Red is a little bit higher, so what you see in here is that you have two dots being formed. So one is sitting here at 3.7. On the first one you could say, oh well, it's related to the boundary, but here's the second one, so not as obvious as the plot, because we don't have enough dynamic range, sitting somewhere at 5 meters. And you also see that these are actually vortices. And if you're plotting this quantity, vorticity, then you see the outer dots even a little bit stronger. So you have really an anti-vortex, an anti-cyclon being formed, and the same one and a similar situation farther inside. And in addition, you see here these streaks in it, and being the vorticity which is plotted here, this refers to Rossby waves, which are transporting angular momentum outwards. Well, that was very interesting. A lot of people already investigated before what happens if you have vortices in the disk. So they were just feeding them in there and then looking how long it takes till they decay. And they were always decaying in their calculations because in their barotropic calculations there was some resistivity, some dissipation. Some people also used alpha viscosity in there. And so they were just looking how long does it take till we have eaten up all the vortices. These vortices are very interesting because it's known that dust grains try to concentrate in them because there are some pressure gradients just putting in there, or yes, so locally changing the effect potential. And you're also, as you saw before, you're locally increasing the mass, so this could be maybe just the initial peak for planetary formation.
Are these creatures permanent features?
In the sense of as permanent as we could run the calculation.
Vortices usually have an incompressible hydrodynamics. Mm-hmm. Vortex have less pressure, less density.
Depends on which direction these are taking. So.
Oh, I see. So
anti-cyclones and cyclones. And you see that the trick here is everything which is on the inner part is rotating a little bit quicker than the local Capricorn profile, and he's slower, that's why it's pushing to the other.
Are you at all concerned that you may introduce vorticity from the remap because you have to rescale velocities and things? Because already when you don't rescale, there are issues about generating vorticity.
Right, I was very concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It took me very long to believe that it's not necessary. And by doing 2D calculations, I will show you. So it's the same computational domain, just a different run at a lower resolution. What I show here is in this box the shape of the convective pattern, because this was the way we started into this business. So coming from convection and looking what's convection doing. So you see here this very similar to the Bowers Hollow report I showed you, Bowers stone, so stone bowers. This is the midplane of the disk, the azimuth, radius, vertical structure. Red is rising gas and blue is falling gas. So this is what you learn from looking at the convective velocity. If you are looking at density and velocities in the midplane of the disk, you get a very different picture, which is looking like this. So even at the same time step, you don't see the convections felt anymore. So there are completely different things going on. So these are densities, actually surface density, over density and lower density, and the mean. You see here waves propagating, you have here vortices being introduced in it. And if you're looking at the stresses now and the strength of the turbulence, so get the numbers, you see the following. So first of all, these alpha stresses in this calculation is alpha r5. Which corresponds to the angular momentum transfer, was positive and stronger than 10 to minus 3 in the radial mean. You can also look at other components of the turbulent stress tensor, and then we see, for instance, that the alpha RR component, so the turbulent fluctuation strength in the radial direction, is stronger than 0.1. It's very similar strong in the phi direction. Also 0.1, and if you're looking at the vertical fluctuations, which corresponds to the convective velocity, it's an order of magnitude less. So whatever is going on in there is a two-dimensional phi flow, and the vertical structure which is coming up in this flow is just confusing us. And the last number here is giving you the Mach number of the flow. You see you are already very close to sonic. So actually several zones in the flow we saw before are transonic. If you're looking at the turbulent spectrum and the azimuth correction, first it didn't make very much sense to me. Even we have bad resolution in this calculation, it's only 60 bit points in the azimuth. But what I want to show you is K minus 5/3, this is the Kolmogorov part, which is only fulfilled in the lowest.
That's resolution, come on.
Yeah, okay, right. I show you that this is just a tendency. And the rest of it, I just want to say, in principle, steeper than Kolmogorov. Okay. And it's even steeper than K minus 1/3. And I was just starting to be happy again when I saw that this is very similar to what we have in the Earth atmosphere, where you have some small scale range, which is Kolmogorov like, and as soon as you're coming to larger structures where the Coriolis force is getting formed and rotational effects, then you're going into geostrophic.
Actually, I just gave a lecture on that.
Good.
But it's certainly no steeper than minus 3. It's more like 2.5. It's a very, very large scale in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not steeper.
Speaking of geostrophics, do you encounter anything like zonal flows? Which I believe here, of course, you have to reconcile to the presence of the mean kept sheared Keplerian flow. But in other words, I would expect there might be, under certain circumstances, a possibility of some thin layer formation.
Difficult to say. In the
that's kind of a generic property, right, of Rossby wave systems.
Yeah.
Couple energy.
We have anyway already problems to calculate the mean profile with what, because it is this locally subkeplerian, but you're right, we have local deviations from from the Keplerian profile strongly, and you can interpret this as zonal flows.
Because, I mean, the reason why that is pertinent, of course, is that those things become an excellent repository of energy.
and they can affect certain similar, many sort of these geostrophic type systems. The main saturation mechanism of the primary instability is just to couple the energy into those symmetric modes that can be very, very weakly damped. So.
But you just said barotropic, and we showed that this actually doesn't happen if you have barotropic.
No, I mean geostrophic.
Okay, so. We said it. So we are now believing that it has something to do with a global baroplanic instability. This is what's behind that. I was actually very worried about my boundary conditions in order to get really to get a handle how much is introducing their turbulence and so on. And so I said, well, if it's really convection, just let's switch off convection and then see whether it's still there or not. And it was switching off convection, replacing it by a polytrop, and it was still turbulent. And so the next step was I was removing the vertical structure of the disk and just having the midplane. It was still turbulent. And so I was meanwhile very worried it could be the boundary conditions. Did I change the way in which I calculate the polytrop? And this is the story. So in most calculations in literature, you find the polytrop just as polytropic constant times density to the power of gamma. Or if you are dealing in a 2D flat disk, you will have to translate this gamma slightly. In order to be a function for the exponent for the surface then. But if you're looking at the pressure as it should be in a disk, so, and this is not a question, temperature structure or gravity, and you see pressure should be something like surface density you have locally times the gravity which is acting. Gravity is in the disk omega squared times z, so typical height is d. Surface density times this gives you something like surface density omega squared r squared, where I just assume that the pressure scale height of the disk is always proportional to radius. And then you end up with something, density times radius minus 1. And already from this you see that k, which in this calculation is always proportional to entropy, cannot longer be a constant. And this is just a pure result of the gravitational gradient which we have noted. In fact, if we are assuming our calculations, we know that surface density is for a certain radii constant around 5 AU, so we have a density drop of r to the minus 1. This gives us an index for this polytropic constant of 0.57. And if you put this description of this kind of polytrop with a radial variable k into the baroclinic term here, then you see that it's always proportional to minus beta k, and then the azimuthal gradient in density. And now you see whenever there's a density fluctuation just in the azimuth, it automatically transports, it's already moving momentum in a radial direction, creating some oscillation. And going on.
That's an interesting question. In equation 3?
Yep.
For a thin disk, I would have thought that it would be omega squared h squared instead of r squared. But
this there is proportional, and h over r is constant.
Okay, so it's not equal. Why are you doing h over r constant?
Observation. Observation of the calculations. So.
Depends on temperature.
Right, exactly. But from the details, 2D calculations, as well as from the vertical structure models, the atmospheric models, you see that there are very broad regimes of the disk where h over r is actually constant. If you're doing so, just using the dust capacity.
Okay.
And we were just concentrating on them, but you see that you can have different relations for h over r being a function, and still you have this baroclinic term. There's only one certain h over r relation where actually this baroclinic term was cancelled, and it's doubtful that exactly this one would be chosen.
that if you did choose that one, you lose the turbulence.
That's what I hope to. So if I'm looking into my three calculations which I presented in the beginning, I can calculate now this polytropic constant as a just temperature and then density 1 minus 1 is gamma, and then you see so the general trend in here, that this is a theoretical predicted value, and as I'm doing a 3D radiation calculation, so it's not really, it's not a polytrop, you have some local fluctuations from the heating and cooling, but you see the general trend in there. And now, just what you said, so let's now do, just assume a constant K. This is now our standard model for the next two simulations. It's only a section out of the disk. It spans from 4 to 6 astronomical units and over 30 degrees. And it's 64 squares, so still a pretty small, tiny calculation which you can run for many orbital universities. You are kicking this model. Kicking means in this calculation a density perturbation of 1%. And after this didn't have much effect, we also kick this model with stronger ones. But turbulence in these models always decays. This is a barotropic calculation. So the time evolution of such a after a kick looks something like this. So in the first slot here, the kinetic energy in R, and you see it's very quickly dying out here over. Yes, only over 10-20 orders of magnitude left, and then somewhere here in the noise region. The kinetic energy in phi direction, as we said before, it's difficult to say where is zero kinetic phi, it's still rotating, so just approaching a constant value, which is something we tried to subtract the assumed profile, but it's very difficult to guess. So the accretion rate over the innermost grid cell also goes in principle to zero. And the entropy, being the square of the vorticity, also decreases. So the whatever burliness is being introduced into the system decays. And this is now our test also for the boundary conditions. Because we also have this shearing stuff, and in principle all the nasty stuff could be produced as well as in the other calculations.
The constant value just comes from the differential rotation, right? Yeah, you end up with a constant value in the end.
In the entropy.
Entropy.
Yeah, right, because it's difficult to say what's the zero level. So it's a constant shear, constant.
So this is a case where the pressure as a function of radius obeys the particular curve for this rotation rate or something like that? You're saying this is a barotropic case.
Which means K is constant.
Well, it's constant. It's right. Not a function of radius at all.
No, not at all.
But if it is a function of radius,
mm-hmm.
then you can generate turbulence.
That's what I will say.
Okay, you're going to tell us why. Now.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is the test calculation and having a barotropic one, everything decays.
Okay.
And in fact, if I'm measuring Mach number, alpha stress, something like this, I have very low levels of zero, 10 to minus 9. It's 9 as long as you kick the model. In the beginning, you have other stresses, but they are decaying pretty quickly. So, and now it's the same computational domain, same boundary conditions, but now K is a function of radius. And here, you see that also radial density variations are being formed. In the first plot, you saw everything was green. And here you have some density contrast in the model between 100 in the darkest area and 500 in the red areas here. And here these shocks and waves propagating all along in there. If you're looking at the time evolution after the initial kick, you see in radial kinetic energy the following. So it takes some orbits here, up to 30 orbits before it really something is happening. But then energy is flowing in here, and you have here a growth rate already in the first 200 something orbits, 3 orders of magnitude. the kinetic energy in phi is growing more smoothly as soon as you have some, same is true for entropy, and you also see after some time, so the first Reynolds strength are positive, and actually the disk starts to increase measure. I was playing around with the polytropic index, and it shows if it would be higher than the F natural, also the growth rates are stronger. So, but in this kind of polytropic calculation, that was what we ended with. The Reynolds stresses for this particular low resolution calculation were around 3, 4, 5 × 10⁻⁴, which is still pretty low. We started with some resolution studies and see if we just double the resolution locally, we are coming up to values of was 2 or 3 times stronger, just by a factor of 2 resolution. We also get stronger values if we are changing the effection scheme, that the shocks are better treated and better conserved. There's a new algorithm called Fargo, where you have some where you're subtracting some low technicalities. Just better shock capturing scheme, and then also other values were stronger, but this is just preliminary stuff. So you see in this calculation Mach number is typically 0.1. And I said already resolution study, but also it depends on what wave numbers we are possibly able to resolve. So this calculation has not only twice the, it has the same resolution, but it's twice as big, which means the wave numbers which are possible are smaller by a factor of 2. And you see on the first glance, oh well, now the alpha stresses we have here are not only a few times bigger, it's an entire order of magnitude. So we have here 5 × 10⁻³, so 5 × 10⁻⁴ as alpha stress in this calculation. And also the Mach numbers are now in the order between 0.2 and 0.3 of the globe.
Does the Mach number locally increase towards the surface?
Excuse me?
Does the Mach number increase towards the surface?
This is a 2D flat calculation.
Flat.
So we remove the entire molecular structure. But you're right, I can tell you from other calculations, the Mach number increased dramatically above supersonic.
Okay, so the message is essentially that there's a stability that you're talking about, which may not have a name yet.
Clinic.
It's already a two-dimensional instability.
Right, exactly.
The horizontal plane.
That's what we're saying. Yeah. Right. It's difficult to say something about the about the actual values of alpha, as we saw in some calculations it was higher, the next 100 times test it was a little bit smaller again, so the turbulence is not, it's not isotropic, it's not constant in time. Slow features like eddies are being formed, sometimes they're being destroyed again. We saw before at some radius mass was accumulated, it's being redistributed again, so there's a constant up and down in the kind of turbulence, just like sometimes it rains, sometimes sunshine.
Is this being done with heating or with the fixed radial entropy gradient?
These calculations are with the fixed radial entropy.
I mean, it sort of begs the question, in other words,
right.
Is what's the, you know, will you actually get in, with a realistic amount of heating, will you actually get into the steady state turbulent transport, mm-hmm. or will you have sort of, you just, you know, you, the instability, you just flatten the gradient, and you have sort of a cyclic process, et cetera, et cetera.
This is my transparency N minus 1.
Okay.
For the time scales that you're talking about, you just see things flopping all over the place, and you never really see things moving off. That was N minus 1.
He freezes the gradient.
Oh, he does.
That's the point of my question.
Even the gradient in these calculations, but we need in order to have the comparison between barotropic and barotropic. So this is the Abelian spectrum of this calculation I just showed you before. And here I'm maybe a little bit better resolved, so and here it's really looking that it's approaching here somewhere the minus 5 third, at least for the wave numbers between 400.
It must be a diffusion range somewhere.
So
yeah.
You can't claim to have any sort of acetide in there at all unless you have a gene where it starts going over steeply into a diffusion regime.
Right, and we don't we switch this off in principle by all our shock engines.
I mean, you should just put in some sort of hyperviscosity or something just to...
That's in principle what this artificial viscosity does.
Oh, you have that in there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I was actually then comparing these simple phototropic calculations with shock capturing and with this shock dissipation and without. It doesn't make a big difference. It just means from 3D calculations that it's more stable to do that.
You mentioned Rickmore about hormones.
Mm-hmm.
No, I understand what he's doing there. I mean, that makes the whole question of whether it's resolved or under-resolved and what this spectrum means in models, so I don't know what to say if you're right or wrong. I mean, you could be right, on the other hand.
Right, just different.
It's different.
When I was doing alpha calculations, like I said before, I really had this type of cue somewhere going on. But then also I had no...
It is encouraging that, you know, a whole half a decade up from your cutoff, you already are starting to sit smooth out. So that is encouraging. It's not like right at the very end like the previous one.
Mm-hmm.
It's encouraging.
So these were all local calculations, but now we saw that we can also do some stuff in 2D already, and in 2D it's not as expensive as 3D. So let's start for a global calculation. And so this means 360 degrees in azimuth.
Can you explain again what you're choosing? What do you mean when you say you're freezing the
gradient? So that I'm taking the K I'm using. Mm-hmm. It's just being a constantly distributed as a polynomial, which is then being used for the entire calculation. People like Paul and Tanga, and what all they did, they were using a constant K for phototropic calculations, but I'm using here for these kind of calculations for a radial distribution of it.
So you're using it, but that's not just your initial condition?
No, in a barrel, if you're doing this phototropic calculation, you always use it.
You use this relation for the background pressure and the density gradient, and also for the factory action.
Why don't you simply just, you know, affect entropy? I mean, why if you take out the heating, why don't you just assume an adiabatic flood equation from your initial conditions? Why are you fixing K like that?
You want to go to clinic, Tom.
If you take it, otherwise I don't
have. So, but in the principle now I can play with different gamma values, one of which is, as you say, the adiabatic term.
Right, so you have an argument for why that should be true in your initial condition, but I don't really see why there's an argument for why that should be reset as a concept rather than, you know, it being an adiabatic dynamical equation.
I see. I just saw it in the 3D calculation already, so when we were tweaking the entire thermodynamics, that it was staying at these values, so that it was not just an arbitrary initial condition. And also we are now having in the last 2D calculations I will present by just one thought, it's again the entire energy generation in the disk in it from shock dissipation and radiation away from the surface, so using some small disk model from vertical structures. And then we see also that the entropy gradient is being this way.
So it must boil down to time scales, because if you're solving the full thermodynamic equation, then the adiabatic terms are in there, but if you come up with something like that, they're dominated by other terms. So what are the primary effects that give you that power law?
Oh, the primary effect is the gravity, so that pressure is
supposed to be... You must have very rapid cooling compared to transport, otherwise you wouldn't reestablish that gradient. Right, you must be heating or cooling must be just in addition to the adiabatic
Oh, right.
That would give you that current motion, that would be what the dominant ones are.
Oh, but the cooling rates are in the order of objects, so.
Okay.
So, and these are also then typical transport time scales, which means if you are transporting mass radially, it will adjust and cool down or heat up.
One could perhaps rephrase Ellen and Eve's question, I think, the following way, is you legislate a gradient that you freeze, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, does the transport that comes out at the end of the calculation, plus, which you presumably can calculate momentum and heat fluxes and blah, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
plus the assumptions you're making on heat and cooling, when you put it all in the energy momentum balance equations, mm-hmm. is it consistent with the gradient you're freezing in?
Yeah, it is.
It is. Okay.
But it's the mean gradient.
Yeah, of course. Okay.
Yeah.
No, but then it begs the question about the small scale structure. But I mean, at least the mean gradient is consistent.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, of course, you have a radial boundary condition where you have some freedom to do what you want. Like, for example, the mass, the density to satisfy the power law and stuff like that.
That is true.
So if you want to deviate from something in principle, you can't in the end.
This is true for the local calculations.
Oh, okay.
And that's the principle then why we are coming up with...
Well, then it's open boundary conditions, right?
Right.
Okay.
And then actually whatever wants to happen can happen.
Okay. I mean, I might suggest an alternative,
mm-hmm.
which would be fixed flux boundary conditions, where instead of freezing a gradient, you simply demand that over the region you're operating, you have to dispose of a certain heat flux, which is then more easily linked to the macroscopic thermodynamics.
In the radial direction?
In the radial direction.
That's what, in principle, I meant by radial squall boundary conditions in the beginning. They were actually a constant flux. But as the typical flux velocities are in the order of centimeters per second, highly subsonic, they are actually acting like reflecting boundary conditions. So you have to have something which is more free than...
The
radial heat flux is negligible anyway.
What is fluctuating on your radial boundary? Is it the...
Density. It's
not outflow through this, okay, but the temperature or the energy flux, is that, you have a choice on the boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Either temperature is fluctuating or the flux is fluctuating
mm-hmm.
at different positions. Which one is fluctuating at your boundaries?
So what do you mean by that? So which one am I using for my boundaries?
You have a fixed gradient. Average gradient, right?
Okay.
At the boundary itself,
uh-huh.
then you have that. You'll have an average value, which is your k.
Mm-hmm.
But that could be satisfied by either a Neumann or a Dirichlet boundary condition on your temperature or your entropy field or whatever
mm-hmm.
at the boundary. And if it's Neumann on one quantity, it's going to be it'll be fluctuating on the other quantity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the classic example is you fix the temperature at the boundary in classical Rayleigh-Gaynard convection. I mean, to any position on the boundary, the heat flux is going to be fluctuating wildly because you have steep temperature gradients
mm-hmm.
at the boundary locally. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you could fix the heat flux going out from the boundary at every point, in which case the temperature will actually fluctuate wildly
mm-hmm.
at the boundary point. And the question is, which of those, in your language,
mm-hmm.
which of those types of boundary conditions are you using, one or the other?
Before that, it was periodic. So there is no the difference.
I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
But I thought this one was global now.
And so this one is actually right, and there I have...
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm feeling lost as well.
So here I have these open outflow boundary conditions for mass.
Right.
And as it's polytropic, I don't think of temperature anyway, not at all.
Okay.
Good. And what you see here is it's a calculator from 1 to 10 astronomical units.
I didn't calculate.
And in the beginning you see a constant distribution of surface density. It's all green. And in the next frame you see that the disk is losing mass in both directions, so you're getting to lower values, but also such a hyper overdensity has formed, and you also see some streaks in here, so some waves propagating through the rest of the disk. This is also a vortex which has a property that is really propagating outward, so here it more is slightly farther out than 2 AU, between 2 and 3 AU, and here it's already at 4 AU, and the final frame is almost out at 6 AU. You see here the second vortex being formed, and the waves propagating from both objects are interacting with each other. And in this frame, it's no problem with the color contrast. It's still here, it's no longer as prominent, so but still at least existent.
Where does the energy come from, the drive instability?
From the shear.
From the stresses?
Yeah.
On the boundaries?
No, they are from the internal, it's open boundary. So it's really, we have a mass accretion rate, mass flowing inwards, and as we move, the kinetic energy is being transformed into turbulence.
So there's a gravity field, which is really worrying.
Oh yeah, right. I didn't show any. Also, in the end of the day, the accretion rates, which we measure in very long-term calculations, fit to the alpha stresses which we have. So, in this sense, it's self-consistent. These are the alpha stresses in the global calculations I just showed you. The strongest stresses are occurring at the boundaries. So where you're really going into vacuum to very low densities, but in the main body of the disk you're always somewhere here at maybe 2 × 10⁻³ in terms of alpha, which is a very satisfying value. Good. And so this is really a global calculation, so that's for the first section formed this into a Cartesian grid again. And so you see it's really quite a part of the disk which is being calculated, and here you see this sheared out, we call in this calculation proto-protojupiter, maybe there where you have already a density enhancement by a factor of 4 in contrast to the rest of the disk, and a factor of 2 in comparison to the initial distribution.
Is it really turbulent, or is it basically just
it's geostrophic turbulence.
So it seems like the basic eigenmode is to pump up
and radius. It's where everything is ending up. Point. So these are long-lived features. So
that
there is some turbulence acting on small scales and that's shifting the energy.
What you've got is a planetary disk modon sort of thing. It's like these blocking highs that, like the one that's sitting off the coast of California right now, making our beautiful weather.
Right.
And it's running anti-time completely, and it's
forcing. Or something like Jupiter's red spot.
Yes, right. Jupiter's red spot is a better example. Inside, there really isn't a whole lot of turbulence. The turbulence is all on the outside, spinning it all up.
Mm-hmm.
And Phil Marcus has beautiful simulations where you can see this all happening.
And a little bit more of the flow pattern you see in this plot. So, where you see here is the vortex going around, and then you see all the streaks here, which are the waves. So it's the second smaller vortex sitting in the inner part, and then the interaction between them, that is the chaotic part. Right. And this is just another snapshot taken earlier in the calculation, where you see how the vortices then really extend into these Rossby waves, which are propagating into this. Yeah. And meanwhile, as of last week, we said we try not to get rid of the polytropic indices business, And this is a calculation just looking like what we have seen before, but here we have local heat generation and local cooling, where the cooling is calculated from the dust opacity in there. But it's again a local calculation, which means we are still fixing in principle the global density gradient in this calculation. But now we already started to do calculations, the global one with open boundary conditions and also with heating and cooling business. And the first impression from these calculations is growth rates are even better than with this fixed polytropic distribution we had before.
And what do you mean by the heating and cooling calculation?
Heating comes from the PD lever as well as from the Meyer-Lichtner viscosity. And cooling is being calculated how much energy is being radiated away from the surface of this. Where the surface density, the surface temperature is calculated from the estimated optical depth and it's a function of surface density and local opacity. Which works somehow nicely. So these are our conclusions. We have a hydrodynamical turbulence in the feature disk. It's not 3D homogeneous isotropic turbulence, by far not. It's some 2D turbulence which is going on, geotropic stuff. You have irregular waves propagating around in there and velocities. And we think now in opposite to other words before, we considered that this are not per se barotropic, but naturally baroclinic, which is a function, but just an effect of the gravity gradient in the disk. And we think that this leads to this global baroclinic instability. And we call it global baroclinic instability because there have been a lot of works which considered what happens if we create a local entropy bump in the disk and showed that this also be indeterminate, but they always have to have problems to explain where this local bump comes from. So this is exactly the difference. So this is a global weak gradient in entropy. So we measure angular momentum transport 10 to minus 4, 10 to minus 2. We think this is okay. We appreciate fit to these values, 10 to minus 9, 10 to minus 7. The energy balance, as far as we can tell, tip all also. We are observing longer pulses, which are very nice for all the planetary guys. That this could, we hope, decrease the time scale in the planetary formation process. And another outcome is we don't think anymore that there would be a tacit death zone, even though interesting questions arise, like how is actually the interaction between this kind of instability with magneto hydro stuff, where it's hot enough that this could be ionized. Very interesting for the future. And another point is, even we are calculating alpha values out of these models, it's a big warning. You can just stick them now again into a whispered calculation, which was actually the hope for years, that one would calculate alpha as a result from 3D isotropic turbulence, and then stick it into an implicit code, and then run the entire simulation for 10 to 8, 10 to 9 years. But as we have seen in this global calculation, there are so many things happening, like what is the scene form, like waves, like local density enhancement, which all cannot be predicted by a diffusion code. Okay, thanks for your interest.
Is one of the papers that does it the other way with the entropy bump, is that with Lutwitz and Colgate?
Right.
Okay.
They, for instance, had an entropy local bump of a factor of 10 or 20, and a steepness in radial gradient of minus 7 or so. Arch minus 7, so it was really something, a spike in there.
So, do you have a sort of a simple physical explanation for the sign of the transport?
For the sign of it?
Right.
No, and this is also not related to baroclinic, because already the barotropic calculations show this angular momentum being transferred outwards.
Which Fahrenheit calculation? Which Fahrenheit calculation?
So we confirmed this. There was a work recently by Treta and Frieda last summer where they just put turbulence into the disk, which then obviously decays. But while it decays, it comes to the momentum of the disk.
I mean, in 2D, the sign of momentum transport is kr k theta. So it must be whether it's like a leading or trailing spiral, right? Determines the sign, the mode.
Mm-hmm. But they were at least in the convection calculations of Storm and Barbos, you also saw something like same kind of spirals and still force transport.
But there are, but in three, those are 3D.
Okay.
And in the 3D, there are other.
Okay.
That's one of three terms, which is not the biggest one. So.
True. But this actually is a thing I'm working with Control Video on, so why is pointing in each direction? But I think there are words, so which are considering if you have vortices turning left or prograde or retrograde, they're doing certain things. But also, I cannot tell you at the moment whether the vortices are transporting stuff or whether it's a wave in between the vortices or.
Sort of another question on these lines. How good or bad does mixing like theory do in describing the mean transport?
Oh, yeah, you saw. Good question. Very bad. At least if you are using the standard estimations for mixing for the length and the mixing length. So, for instance, so if you're looking at the alpha RR, so the 5 prime and the other body here being 10 to minus 3, oh no, it's easier if you're looking at the Mach number. The Mach number of 0.1, and then you only have an R5 of 0.001, means that you have a mixing length which is only 100. Of your typical length, which is pretty short. Mm-hmm. So you see.
Surely it should depend on what the wavelength of the
instrument. Yes.
That is true, but this wavelength even doesn't exist in our calculations, so it's too short. So
what do you think?
So the wavelength of 100 of the pressure scale.
Right, but you have a small
script,
you know.
That's true.
So
the mixing length which is coming out of this calculation, so of this estimation, is smaller than our grid. Which shows that the angular momentum transport is very inefficient in comparison to the velocities which we have.
So the angular viscosity is less than the numerical viscosity. That's what I mean.
No, what I just mean is just having, I have here the Mach number of the velocity fluctuation, which is 0.1 multiplied by a length scale, and then I'm ending up here by 10 to minus 3 on the other side for my transport, and this gives me here an L which is in the order of 10 to minus 2 times the pressure scale height.
Right, but doesn't it mean that the effective viscosity, the turbulent viscosity, is very small?
What do you mean?
Yeah, right. So it's much smaller than the microscopic one that you would have to have in your simulation.
It's unavoidable from the
grid.
Yeah.
No, the viscosity is not that small because I5 is
1,000. Yeah, I mean the 1,000 is small compared to the inverse mesh. Number. I mean, you must compare that to 1 over the number of mesh points.
Well, in the viscosity, there is an L and a V, so you
also
make an assumption about the V here,
yes.
And you get a small L.
But we know that already. It's 1/10. V is 1/10 relative to the sound speed.
Is another possibility something in the phase relation between VR
and VR? That is the answer, absolutely, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The mixing length is just not the right approach for calculating the
Another question is maybe whether this instability is actually familiar or not. I mean, at this point, the whole audience was sort of quiet and said, ah, yes, one of these new instabilities again. So first of all, is this really a global one, or is it actually already present in a local analysis? That's one question. And I mean, as we discussed earlier, it is exactly the regime where the disk is, fast shifts, unstable, but stabilized again by the centrifugal force.
Right.
So it is Hoyland stable.
That's what we find.
Fast shifts unstable.
Right.
So is that a scenario which has actually been studied in the past or not? The question of the audience, really.
I don't know, but if you think that this, do you think that this is a local baroclinic instability, or do you really need boundary conditions?
It's easier to get the global distribution of entropy in comparison. So that's why I think it's.
I mean, for a fixed gradient given by that, can you do a WKB analysis?
We are thinking about this, yeah. We haven't asked yet. Still too new. We were too busy so far with the numerical stuff that we find.
Does this connect with the work that Knobloch and Spreit did in the mid-80s or so?
They actually, as well as Kellett, studied vertical baroclinic instabilities.
And I think they really had a baroclinic term in the basic state already, is that right? I mean,
they had no calculation, so they had no
basic structure. It was referred to, applied to the sun, of course. And so the sun is rotating, and so you have the planes of entropy and temperature that are inclined already.
For these words, we are thinking about the disk words.
I remember the paper of 83, which was really was
something
to scare.
Another one.
Another one.